Canon Press presents Glory Makers, The Grace Agenda 2012, pre-seminar featuring Nancy Wilson, Rachel Jankovic, Becca Merkel, and Heather Wilson. Sponsored by Christ Church, Moscow, Idaho. Copyright 2012. Thank you for listening to Glory Makers.
So I guess we're taking turns. So I will go first. Hold on. You said we must take care where we get our beauty cues from. If our husband is fairly unopinionated about our makeup, hair, clothing, as long as it is modest, or unopinionated about home decor or a well-laid table, where should we get those beauty cues from? How do we discern godly beauty from worldly beauty, i.e. in home decor? Okay, that's actually sort of a big question. Okay, if your husband is unopinionated, there are ways of finding out. And when we were remodeling this house, and we were tearing apart the kitchen, and I would try and ask my husband what he wanted, he would look at me like blank. I don't know. And, you know, and I'd be like, well, what would you think about this paint color? And he just kind of glazes over and doesn't have a thought. So then I would show him pictures of, like, how about this kitchen? And actually, I discovered that, okay, if you ask the question the right way, you can actually figure out what he likes, because I showed him this one and it was totally beautiful. It was like really lots of white and sparkle and beautiful. And he looked at it and he said, that kitchen looks like it would smell like ammonia. And he goes, you want a kitchen that looks like it smells like a roast is in the oven? I was like, okay, you want it to look like it smells like a roast. And then I was like, okay, I can work with that, actually. I can do that. So then it's like, okay, right, he doesn't want it to look like it smells like Pine Sol. So, right, you know, and then you go with that. But actually, it turned out in the end, he was like, yeah, I really like this. But he couldn't have told me, you know, you give him the fabric swatch and he'll, you know, probably light himself on fire. So, but if you just really try and take the time and really try and find out his opinion, you probably can do it. So if you ask him, like, what do you think? Should we set the table like this? He'll probably go like, fine, great, whatever. But, you know, you might need to be creative a little bit and try and find out what he really likes. Or if you really want to find out what was this well-laid table or home decor, you know, maybe he seriously doesn't care. And if he doesn't care, well, go with what you want. That's kind of fun. But, you know, you might be able to figure it out. What does he think? Like, what restaurants does he like? Or where does he like to go? Or, you know, just study him, because he might not be able to articulate it, but that's kind of our job, right? As the wife, we're supposed to sort of embody things in a way that he can't. And, of course, it's the whole total proverbial thing about a woman's touch. Guys aren't good at that, usually. And if they are, sometimes it's a bit problematic, but not always, sometimes though. But anyway, so we're supposed to like take the principle and then give it, you know, flesh, basically. So in the end, yeah, with our kitchen, it was quite funny, but I liked that. So I learned, like, okay, so you want it to look like it smells like a certain thing, or, you know, with different, like, I, for instance, like the bedroom, he hates like smothery feelings. I think he would like it if it looked like it was freezing cold. Which for me, that's like, I like being warm. But anyway, you know, but just like, you can go with that. You can make decorating decisions that work with that. And so just study him and see if you can get an opinion. And if you can't get an opinion, well, then just go with what you like and know that he's happy with that. And that's great. In terms of getting beauty cues from the world, what I mean, that one is more, honestly, it's like if you're reading Cosmo, hopefully you've got that sorted out, that's kind of like hooker training camp. So probably not. Like, don't go there for your beauty cues. That one's kind of on the surface. That one's going to be obvious, right? So try and be discerning in where you get it from. And if that's your ideal, but it's like, and then the Bible wants me to be modest, how am I going to do that? you know, because that's my ideal, and the Bible's always getting in the way of what I'm trying to do. So that's what I mean by watch for where you're getting your beauty cues from, because if that's what you want, and then the Bible's always ruining your party because now you have to be modest, you know, then you're probably getting your cues from the wrong places. And in terms of home decor, I mean, it's just the thing of read the story. There's a lot that you can, if you just start looking at like home decorator magazines, it's amazing how much people's worldview comes out in their choices for how the house looks. I mean, like, it really is amazing. And if you just try and be a Christian about it, try and be perceptive, think, okay, when somebody makes their house completely sterile and modern and there's nothing in it and it's all granite and steel and perfectly, you know, what are they saying? It's not surprising. Those are the people. There's no children in that house. It's sterile for a reason, right? It's a, like, there's a barren, sterile mindset that a lot of modern Americans have embraced, and it's not surprising. It comes out in a barren and sterile life as well. It's like their house is reflecting that. So as you look at, you know, magazines, home decorator magazines or whatever, and try, you know, like, maybe you don't really know what you like, so you're gonna look through magazines and see if you can figure out what you think looks good and what you like, and trying to develop a style or an opinion. Just pay attention to those things. And I remember reading a couple biographies of Chanel, Coco Chanel, a while ago, because I naively thought there might be some interesting sewing tips in there. And I was totally stunned. That woman was hideous. And she completely changed fashion, like completely changed it. And she was doing it from very, very spelled out and conscious motives of, she had a worldview and an agenda, and she was going to push it, and she was going to do it through fashion. And she did. And she was the one who actually introduced pants for women. I'm not opposed to pants for women. But she's the first one who did it, and she was doing it for very particular reasons, and it wasn't feminism. It was actually lesbianism. Like, self-consciously, it was a cross-dressing thing. It was a weird sexual deal. And she's the one who made that mainstream. And of course, now that's not what we mean when we do it, but that is what she meant when she did it. And so she totally changed the whole face of fashion. Like, when she was young, they were still wearing the, you know, ruffly necks up to here, and she's the one who invented the little black dress, you know, like, she completely changed fashion. But she was doing it because she self-consciously hated God, and she wanted to push that agenda. So the same, I mean, she was friends with all these influential architects and artists, and they were all doing the same thing in their own arenas. So what Picasso was doing to art and Gropius was doing to architecture, she was doing to women. And it comes out, like, what your worldview is comes out in fashion. So as you're trying to, you know, get beauty cues or home decorator ideas or whatever, just know that these things always have, you know, context, and there's always something there. So just pay attention to the bigger story. Don't just look at the details, but try and step back and see, what is this? What is that house? What is that saying about life, about creation, etc.? So, all right, long answer. Okay.
Okay, Rachel, I love thinking about living our lives, embracing our stories, and learning to read the stories God put around us. I have been called to come alongside two friends whose young daughters have been raped, one by a teacher, one by a fellow employee. How can I help them embrace the season of their lives in a redemptive way while acknowledging how painful the experience is? Okay, this is obviously a much bigger kind of a storyline than, say, someone being rude at Walmart. So, first of all, I would say that these people need more than a friend coming alongside of them, and probably need pastoral counsel and help. I'm assuming with these comments that they have that those people have actually someone really working through it to counsel them through it. So with that assumption, I would say this is another plug for Notes from the Tilt-A-Whirl, which is a book all about the problem of evil and how God can use darkness in a bigger story. So the first thing I would say is, as far as this story goes, listen to the end. Like, be patient with what God is unfolding, because there can be very hard parts in stories that by the end you can look back and see how that laid the groundwork for a lot of other things. I know we know a number of different families who have been used in ministry through real hardship, who have started out like started out with children with major disabilities or problems, where God used those things to really sanctify them and bring them through the fire, where they came out the other end equipped to minister to other people. So listen to the end of the story. It's not like, and scene, that's it. Now don't you see, like, this is a lifelong story for those people. So I would recommend the book Tilt-A-Whirl, and also just patience and real pastoral help with something like that. That's definitely not something you field in a real, like, let's all get together and just chat about it. And that should do ya. That's definitely the kind of thing that takes any kind of abuse or real difficulty. But recognize that God is the author of that story. God is using that in some way, and he's told us in his word that he loves us. He loves his children. So we know that he will work this for good, and he will, which does not mean that everything that happens will be easy, but we know that what God gives us is that God loves us and loves us through it. Are we supposed to take turns, or should... No, I'll come back.
Okay, I'll read the question. What about almost successes? Child gets second, is that what it says? Either because of lack of practice or just plain got beat. How do you help them still celebrate? Also, is competition Christian? Well, as far as almost successes, I think it's because of lack of practice, and it's a time for us to say, well, let's work harder. I mean, we look at the second as opposed to the first, and we talk about it. Did you do your best? If you did your best, great. Do you want to get first? Let's work harder. So you can be very affirming and tell them, great, great work. Let's try harder. If first is what we want, let's try harder. But we also, if it's a lack of practice, then that's more obvious. It's like, well, we've got to work harder. This lets us know that. But if you tried your hardest and you still got beat, you don't celebrate it as if it were first. So it's not like all of a sudden, you know, first is the same as second because we all try it hard. It's like, no, first is still first, and let's go for that next time. So I think you're perfectly able as a parent to celebrate their hard work and a good achievement. If you get the B or you get the C when you'd been getting Fs and Ds, you can celebrate that C and still say, oh, let's go for the A. If you got a B and you actually could have gotten an A if you would have opened your book, you know, the B is nothing to celebrate. So it all depends the context of whatever, you know, whatever the second or B or D was in. So as far as helping them still celebrate, I think, yes, it's celebrate as with everything. You worked hard, let's work harder, you know. So it's... I've never, you know, being the little league mom or soccer mom who just gets on their case, like, second's not good enough, you know, that loss, you know, it's like you have to always be encouraging them, even if you're telling them to work harder. You know, it's not about their, you know, you don't get on their case, you don't be ever that parent who's just yelling from the sidelines at them. You know, you always want to be the one who's cheering, not yelling, especially in the public setting. As far as competition being Christian, I mean, we're told in the Bible, it's like run the race. I mean, a race implies winners and losers, you know? It's like competitions are not unchristian at all. It's just one more place which we can learn. We can learn lessons about attitudes, about hard work, and I think competitions are very healthy, especially sports competitions, because you're able to work through a lot of issues that there's really not many other places to, because you get in the world, and you're always, you know, there's always people trying to get ahead. There's always places you'll fail, and fail because you didn't work hard enough or because you just weren't good enough. And so you can work out a lot of the emotions about that in the context of just the sports field. And so a lot of times we just have put kids in things not because, oh, it's their best thing ever, but because we want them to be able to struggle with the emotions about winning and losing and working hard in an environment where we get to watch, where we get to cheer on, not because we need them to win the game or score the point, but because the team dynamic, which is what we are. I mean, we're called, we live as brothers and sisters. You know, we're a big family, a Christian family, a Christian team, you know, and being able to cheer each other on and be excited and, you know, have disappointments without the resentments, you know, because I don't know, I for one was the kind of kid as far as I could have used more team competition. I ended up doing the solo sports because I hated, and this is very conscious, I remember, I mean, I was 8, 9, I didn't like the soccer because I didn't like being let down when my teammates let me down. I didn't like to be the one who let them down. And it was very much, well, if I just do gymnastics, that's just me, you know, and, but those lessons that I was learning on the field were teaching me about disappointment, excitement, and when people do let you down, how can you respond? And how, you know, how will you let it, how will you let people affect you, their ups, their downs? Because I know, you know, Nate has lots of great examples of this from his sporting career, you know, football, you know, having somebody throw the game, you know, and it's just somebody throws the game, you're up for states, and somebody throws the game, it's like, you know what, people do that all the time in real life. Once you get off the field, people throw games. It's not fair. Refs are evil, you know? And, you know, I mean, they can be. And do you, are you going to be the one just standing, stomping your foot on the sideline of life? It's not fair. No. And so as far as competition goes, as far as I think we have great opportunities, whether it's in sports or other areas, to really encourage and teach our kids in the context of competition. Not that it's all about winning, but if we're supposed to be learning discipline and working hard, a lot of time winning is what comes out of it. And learning to enjoy that, but also learning how to work your hardest and still not get the gold, you know, still get fourth, you know, in your Olympics. I mean, like, think of that. Like, every time I watch the Olympics, I think of those poor people. Like, where they give the whole little montage about their family, like, giving up everything. You know, five kids do nothing so this one person can, you know, make their practices. And then they go to the Olympics and fourth. You know? And so we have to deal with wins and losses and disappointments. And I just encourage people who have kids to give them that opportunity early in life, because it will really help them just as life goes on. So,
all right, I'm going to take a couple together. One is, can you address how to honor a father who's not godly, not loyal, not a good example to your children, not a dangerous man, just a not all these other things? And the second one is, how can a wife best help her husband when he is sometimes harsher with the children than he should be, and he wants to be better? All right, the first one. If your father is not a believer, or if he's not an honorable man, you don't have to pretend that he is. But the Bible says, children, you know, honor your parents. It doesn't say if they're honorable people. It's just honor your parents. So you render it unto the Lord. You say, Lord, help me honor my dad. He has all these issues. He's fallen. He's failed. He's not loyal or whatever. So how do you treat him? Well, you treat him with courtesy. He's your dad. You thank him for whatever. You may have to sit down and brainstorm and make a list. And I think the same thing applies to wives who have husbands who are not being respectable. It's a way of showing respect and honor to people that maybe don't, in our mind, deserve it. So what do? We'll sit down and brainstorm. What has my dad ever done that was good for me? What kind of strengths does my husband have that I can actually thank God for and thank my husband for? So I would start, daughters, thank God for your dads and start expressing that gratitude to him. And for wives, the same thing, just start saying, thank you for fixing the car. Thank you for taking us to church. Thank you for, you know, just being respectful, honoring him, being courteous, not talking to him like he's one of the kids, etc. So honor him. Honor him in every way you can. Let love cover sins. Ask God for, going back to some of what the girls have said about stories, let some of his behavior be a sermon to you. Okay, so he's being disloyal to me, so all the more reason for me to display loyalty here. Right, so let it affect your own behavior. Don't think that you shouldn't have to honor him anymore because he is not being honorable in some way. Pray for him, of course. And both of these seem to be written by wives, not daughters. Honor a father who's not a good example to your children. I think, let's just say it doesn't sound like this father is necessarily this way, but let's just say the one listed here. Anyway, let's just say your husband cusses you out in front of the kids. Or you're going to discipline one of the children or speak to one of the children, and he's just using terrible language in front of the kids. You don't have to pretend that was great and say, oh, honey, do what your dad does. Isn't that great? No, I mean, you follow through. You say, it's okay to say, you know, we aren't going to talk that way, particularly if one of the kids starts to talk that way. Like, well, daddy called you that. Can I call you that too? And say, no, we forgive daddy for that. That isn't the way we're going to speak. That's not pleasing to God. But we forgive him, and we go on. So we don't pretend. So if your husband is being too harsh with the kids, and he knows it, I'd say it sounds like it's a conversation you've had. Talk about it. How can I help you with this? Why don't you, you know, be available? You don't want to be on him, but say, honey, what do you, you know, how can I help? What should I do? Should we make an appointment with the pastor? I'd be glad to go with you to do that. Do you want, you know, just encourage him, pray for him, say, do you want me to give you a look when I see it coming, to divert it somehow? I mean, just try to get on his team and make a plan. And make a plan when it's not in the midst of the trouble, when things are fine. Say, how can I be a help when you're tempted to get angry with the kids, as you've mentioned before? So I don't think we need to give up and say, well, my husband blew it, and I can never respect him, or I can't honor my dad. It's like, oh, no. Sometimes when men have failed, it's when they're in the greatest need for respect, just like we may need love when we're sometimes the most unlovely. So we don't want our husbands to say, you're just not pretty right now while you're crying and carrying on. I'm going to wait till you pretty up and then I'll love you. You know, so sometimes it's when our husbands have blown it that's when they need respect and honor the most. So don't make your honor and respect conditional. Make it unconditional.
All right. What do you do if your definition of beauty is polar opposite your husband? He likes stuffed fish, wildlife, logs, and camo everywhere. You do not. That is awesome. Actually, this is an awesome question. I love this. Because the thing is that you have to, again, think, what is the home for? Is it so that I can sit here and look at it and think it's pretty, or am I supposed to be using it to bless somebody else who might live here too? So if it's for your husband, I would say run with that. That is fun. Because it could be done real tacky, I'm sure, but you could.
Thinking of antler chandeliers.
I would love antlers. I love those. Anyways, you could make this gorgeous. You totally could. And I don't know, you know, who asked the question or what your idea of beautiful houses is, you know. But the thing is, Michelangelo's David. Right? The big sculpture of David. That was a piece of flawed marble that another artist rejected because of the flaw. The thing is, sometimes the greatest masterpieces come from having weird constraints, honestly. And that's when real artists can actually really shine the most, is when there's some like bizarre thing that they have to work around, right? So it's the flawed marble, or it's the room with that stupid window in the wrong place. That's when an interior designer who's really good, that's when it shows. Like somebody who's only mediocre, they can only work with something that is already a, you know, perfect setup for a, you know, kind of everything set. You can do something nice here. The place where true artistic creativity really comes out is when there's some just like quirky restraint you have to work around. And this is a huge one, and I think that's totally fun. Because you could make a gorgeous house like that. And if you just try and work with it and get excited about it, like don't sit there resenting it and thinking about all the ways you wish you were having pink chintz on stuff. But if you actually thought, okay, I'm going to roll up my sleeves and I'm going to see if I can figure out how to make a totally stunning house that he will love because it has stuffed fish in it. Just hopefully not the one that flaps and sings. But, I don't know, put it in the bathroom. I don't know. Camo, I'm not so sure about. I don't know where. But just be creative. Like, that's the place where you're going to need to just stretch yourself. But don't do it in a grumpy little way. You know, showing him what a martyr you are because I'm putting the camo, whatever. But that's the one where you really could make a truly beautiful house that was completely that. You really could. It doesn't have to be like, you know, look like the dreadful bachelor pad. It doesn't have to look like that. You could make something totally stunning with it. So I think that's the big thing, is realizing that funny constraints are where lots of the best masterpieces come from. So I would just run with it and have fun with that one.
Okay. So this is a question I know my mother-in-law could have answered, but I will. But I can also answer it. If you are single, how do you know if God is simply calling you or you're simply restless? And I'll enter because you're stuck in Moscow. I would say, as far as calling, and I assume talking about calling you like to missions or to elsewhere. I would say as far as the steps I took in addressing this, and I did it right and wrong, was one is if you're somewhere with your family, obviously seek your parents' guidance and prayers and thoughts on whatever it is and wherever it is you're hoping to go or whatever it is you're hoping to do. If you live away from your family already, I think having good counsel, having older women, your pastor, you know, put it up in prayer and being ready to let go, you know. Like, really, you need, as a single woman, you need to have people you trust. People, you know, if you don't have a husband, you're saying, what do you think, hon? You know, it's like having people who really are looking out for you is really important. And part of as far as calling you goes, I did a lot of missions when I was younger, and some were great situations, some were really bad situations. When you're looking at the opportunities that seem to be, you know, out there, and the things, maybe the doors you see, maybe God's opened, is you have to really look at them as far as making wise decisions. You know, God doesn't call us, you know, as women, just to step out there by ourselves. Very often, apart, you know, as Christians, we're called to be in community, we're called to be in fellowship, and a lot of times when missions opportunities arise or put before us, or people are trying to get us to jump on board, it takes us away from that, and that can leave you very vulnerable. So as you look at whatever, you know, whatever the call you're seeing, it's like, you look, is there a church? Is there a family, or is there a church community where people, I can get to know people, they will get to know me, and I will, you know, have some accountability, you know, or is it something that's really going to take me out on my own? Because the problem is when you go out on the mission field, or when you go out, when you decide to kind of, you know, do the world's thing, just go out and on your own, you know, go to New York, live by yourself, and, you know, get to see what the world has to offer. It has to offer a lot, you know, and you don't really find you don't really know what danger you could be in until you find yourself in it. And you don't, you know, so you want to really make those steps, you know, in counsel. And that's as far as call. I think it's very easy to confuse call with just desire. And that's why using, you know, having counselors, I think, is very, very important in this case. Called to what? Called to be where? Called to be with who? Because especially as far as the missions go, there's lots and lots of stories, you know, of girls and older women, you know, who've come home very broken because they weren't in fellowship. And male or female, you know, being left on your own is never a good thing as a Christian. It's just not. We're not called to be just alone. So that's one thing. As far as if you're being called to missions, I think a lot of times we got to get broader with what that could mean as far as service goes, because a lot of people like the romantic idea of missions. Like, missions means I get to go off across the globe. They don't think of missions as far as here, as far as what are the ways you can serve your church community? What are the international missions here in Moscow, you know, for instance? Or if you feel really called to a particular people group, you know, what are places here in the States where there's churches and communities that serve those people? And that's one thing, you know, people have told me, you know, I really feel for this particular Middle Eastern group of people. It's like, well, there are large communities of immigrants, you know, in this church. And this is a good reform, solid church. There's good pastors, good counsel, you know, and you can actually get to know this people group. You can get to know their culture, get to serve them, but in a place that doesn't leave you just out in the cold. So realizing that we have to actually, especially when we're young and it's much better, you want to fill your passport, that there's a lot you can do to serve even the international communities here in the States or within the context of churches. You know, so that's as far as if God's calling, if you really feel God's calling you, especially towards a particular you know, group of people, you know, nationality or something, I would encourage you to look at ways you could serve them, serve that community here, and then, or within the context of missionaries who are doing it, where you can serve, find ways to serve them, you know, because that is, you know, a lot of missionaries, you know, Donna, there's lots of ways that people can come serve, you know, and I think we don't want to always do just the stuff that feels like grunt work here, you know, so that would be my thing. As far as God calling you, it's like if God's really calling you, he'll give you a way to do it, you know, and he'll give you a way to do it that doesn't leave you in danger, you know, so that's my thought. And as far as Simply Restless, you know, and I had a lot of the Simply Restless bit, and for me, I was always looking for the, I was really wanting to change the world. Like from a young age, I had, you know, the I want to change the world button pretty much. And I realized that I wasn't being faithful. And I talked about this last year a lot. I realized that actually I wasn't being kind to my siblings. I wasn't serving my parents. I wasn't serving my church. So as far as is God calling me, I felt called. But he called me to obedience. He called me to honoring my mother and father. He called me to serving my brothers and sisters, and so I would check that also. As far as the call goes, check first, are you being obedient in the immediate calls that are concrete, you know, that aren't things you just have to pray about. No, the Bible says X, Y, and Z. Are you being faithful in those callings that you don't have to actually pray about? I mean, you should pray about, you know, fulfilling them, but you don't have to pray about their concrete. And once you're doing that, I've found that lots of people, once they take care of that, there are they get blessed with the next thing. And the next thing isn't out of restlessness. The next thing is actually natural. So, there.
Okay, this one says, being the wife of a pastor, my children are often watched. I love your understanding of others seeing your story. I've often told my children, yes, the people in the congregation watch you more than they watch others, so what are you going to show them? Your dad tries to get their attention to share God's gospel with them, and you naturally get their attention, so be mindful of your story. So this is more a prompt, really, than a question, but we definitely grew up in what we fondly call the fishbowl, and I know that I'm sure that had funny effects, but we never knew anything else. So that was the fishbowl mentality came quite naturally. However, I would say in my talk, I talked about sometimes God can use you as an example for others. And there is a real temptation for Christian, especially mothers, I think Christians of every kind, to put on a show as though we're always, like as though the point of all this is that someone might watch it and needs to be admonished in this moment. Some communities are much worse this way. Worse this way than others, in the sense of I would think of like Southern churches where you have to have everything together and look meticulous and be perfect because it all kind of is a show. So of course the fundamental thing is that you should care more about what God is seeing, about what he's seeing you applying, and what other people get is really not your business, in the sense that if you're prioritizing being faithful and applying what you're learning, then other people will see that. But if you're putting on a show for other people, most of the time you're being hypocritical. I know I mentioned the example of us going into Costco or something, and people counting your children or whatever. Well, a lot of those times, that would be me at the end of the day, having run past the mirror in the morning at some point. Definitely, we were not putting on a show to, like, this will be a good advertisement for anyone we run into at Costco. You never know how God will use those things. But if you are being faithful, and I know, I think church, especially in our community, people keep their children in the church service with us. So although there are, you know, the nursery for crying babies, why you would need that unless, but there is a nursery for that. Keeping your children in the service creates sort of a bit of a, people will see if I have kids acting up, people will know. And we've had hilarious times where people are like, well, I saw your husband having to take your kids out a lot. I'm just like, yep, you did. Like, because that's what we did. We were just doing that a lot. I was like, yes, that's how it went. And but if you're prioritizing being faithful, it doesn't matter what people are seeing. It doesn't even matter what they say to you about what they saw. We have had comments when I know we were being faithful parents that we probably looked the least together. Like the times when we were going to basically... There have been times, okay, when the kids were a little bit younger, my husband and I have seen each other down out of the building of church. Like, I'm passing with two children, and he's passing with two children. It's like, should we even be here? Should we just go get a coffee or something? Like, we're just out as a family. We come, we put our stuff on some chairs, and then we leave. That's what we do. And it's like, we'll come back afterwards and pick up the bulletins. I mean, it's like, we've done that. But those times when we were faithfully trying to do what we knew God wanted us to do and taking joy in that, those times, I know some people probably did get a bad, like, they could have gotten a bad impression of us, but that's not my business. Like, that doesn't matter. God will work that out for them at other times. The times when people could think, wow, they have it all together. Could be the times when you're giving people stink eyes and being like, you will not budge out of that chair. Like, I mean, you could not be doing a good job and people would think, oh my word, we should imitate that. So, and it's true. That's what you see. You don't know the whole backstory. So I would just say primarily when you know you will be seen, but you will always be seen by God and you will be seen in the real details by God, which means that do it unto him and how he uses it for other people to see is completely up to him. Should I just do the second one while I'm up here? I think Shadrach might be joining in soon to share with you something. So, this one was for Mom, but she pawned it off. Can you encourage the young mothers who are daily in the trenches of needing to discipline, correct, and chastise little ones and how they can view this as a kindness and maintain a kind attitude towards a stubborn or difficult child? There's a couple of things that I would say about this. First of all, the kindness and maintaining a kind attitude is really part of just holding yourself accountable first, knowing that this is... that your attitude is the first step in everything. And if you are confessing things and little grievances against your children and you are keeping a close eye on that, disciplining and kindness will flow from that. Somebody asked me recently, what do you do when everything just seems really crazy and your kids are all crazy and everything? And I had to think about this, like how do we get a grip when everything seems to have sort of come apart at the seams? And oftentimes, it starts with a gather the kids together because I need to ask your forgiveness for not having been spanking you. Like, will you please forgive me for not having done this quickly first? Because if you are doing that, if you're promptly following through, there is no time to develop a big... So usually it kind of is a two-part meeting. We meet about, I'm sorry I have not been spanking you promptly, and from this time forth... we will be spanking promptly, and that's how we're going to do it, and we're going to do quick tune-ups, get right back in fellowship, and this is what we're doing. And it's remarkable how much that can turn around. And I would say on the very end of this, maintaining a kind attitude towards a stubborn or difficult child, oftentimes there are underlying things at work when you have a stubborn child or something wrong. And one thing I would just mention is that your language about them and about what they're doing is very relevant. So don't label that child like, this is my difficult child. You are my stubborn child. Like, this is the one. Because God puts those things, I talked about story. God gives us these children to challenge certain things in us. And if we see, here's this thing, it keeps happening over and over, and I'm gaining more antagonism towards this child and that behavior, then that means you need to confess something. Like, there is something going on that you need to look at and think, okay, whatever this is, like, this may not be the child being something. This may be me holding on to something that I need to repent of and I need to let go of. And especially, I think the more children you have, the easier it is for one to stand out as, like, that's the one who's always the trouble about that. Like, this, or, and you start identifying them by their struggles. So I would just really recommend, first, quick and kindness has a lot to do with being prompt and discipline, I think, and not letting it work up to a point where you are in sin about it. And secondly, just not labeling your children.
All right, we've got about 5 or 6 more minutes, so I'm going to be quick on this, and then Becca will, I think you have time for one more. Any suggestions for how to be present for your children and teaching boundaries being considerate of another's time? And this has become increasingly more difficult as my children are older and would love to talk for hours at the end of their day, but we do need husband-wife time too. A couple of quick things. Go out for coffee. They're old enough. Maybe you can leave them. Just ditch, say, be back in a little bit. We're going to walk around the block, or we're going to go for coffee. We'll be back in a few minutes. You know, you can, if they're old enough to do this, you could probably disappear shortly. And the other thing is, I don't think we should tell them, sorry, I don't want to hear anymore. I mean, I remember we had a small house. The kids were in high school, and we would all be together. And then Doug and I had our bedroom was right off the living room, very conveniently. We'd say, we're going to go in and visit, so we'll see you later. We'd go in there, and then pretty soon, knock, knock, and pretty soon everyone else is in there with us. It's like, why don't we all go to the living room? But I saw that as a very positive thing and a good thing. So we want to be there for our kids and listen and be patient, but just disappear. I think it can work. All right, Becca.
Okay, so I've got 3 left, so I'm just going to over them really fast. How can those of us from the sloppy, chaotic families distinguish between beauty for ourselves and for the gospel? Do we study the people we respect? Are there practical books? Thanks. I think that there are, yeah, there's a ton of helpful things out there. I mean, there's loads of resources. You can just go down to the bookstore and see what's down there. If you're somebody who maybe didn't grow up and you just don't know, like you don't even know how to set the table and you don't know how to do some of the basic things and everything's kind of chaotic and sloppy, yeah, there's a ton of helps out there. Once you just decide, okay, I'm going to learn about this, it's like picking anything else to study. Like, I'm going to learn about, you know, I don't know, the Napoleonic Wars. You'd go down to the library and see what there is there and start reading. So if you decide, I'm going to get better at this, this is something I'm going to go for, there's a ton of stuff out there. So yeah, you can, and then you've got friends. Find somebody who's good at it and ask them questions and just find out how they do it and get tips and stuff. And how do you distinguish between beauty for ourselves and for the gospel? Well, yeah, I think, I don't know, if you're coming from the end of the spectrum that's sloppy and chaotic, then I think tightening up, you probably don't need to worry just yet that you're in the other ditch. You mentioned dressing for your husband. How do you balance pleasing him with being fashionable if he prefers denim jumpers and little makeup? So yeah, that's another challenge. It's like the home decorating thing. If that's what he likes, that's what you do. And put a smile on it and it'll look a lot better than if it's a denim jumper and a grump. So you can make a denim jumper look better with a good attitude. But the other thing is, and I'll just try and say this very quickly, but I think the world is fundamentally confused on the difference between being beautiful and being hot. So if you've ever thought about that, like, people use the word hot to describe something that frequently isn't beautiful at all. It's just cheap, easy, and available. And so lots of times that gets confused because people say hot and actually they don't, it isn't really beautiful, but then they say hot when it is beautiful and it just gets confused. And I think honestly sometimes Christian men can't tell the difference either. Like they're confused about those two. So, you know, like they don't want you to be in the, you know, trashy category, and they think the only other option is jumpers. And so they would prefer that. So I would just say, do what your husband wants. Do it cheerfully. Submit. Put a smile on. And then, honestly, you could just start gradually adding something. I don't know. See if he minds. But work with what you've got. Last thing, I sometimes struggle with feelings of guilt at how blessed my family is, particularly when others notice and wonder the best way to think through this and how to make others feel comfortable in my home and to not be intimidated. Okay, that one, I don't know. I assume you mean blessed financially or you have a beautiful home and that can make other people all insecure and weird. And honestly, that's nothing to be embarrassed of. If God has blessed you, don't let other people's weird insecurities get you muddled up. Just honor God with what he's given you. Use the blessings to try and bless others. Try and, wherever God has put you, see what you can give. And if other people get like all weird about it, which they will, then don't let that slow you down at all. That's their problem, not yours. And the thing is, I think lots of times we can kind of take on board other people's sins and they can get us all turned up and we can start to stress out about it. And something I talked to my daughters about at school, because like other kids being bad can actually start to really make them feel like really down. And I tell them it's like the water being outside the ship is okay. Once the water gets in the ship, that's the problem. Other people having problems, that's outside the ship. Don't take it on board. So if other people are all, you know, like chippy and weird at you because you've got a beautiful house, that's their thing. I wouldn't take it on board. Don't worry about it. And if you're being selfish, well, then you have to work through that on your own. Okay, I think that's it. All right.